accession number 22354, reel 4.
Terry Jefferson, reel 4.
Right, there are several versions and several verses. The thing about Göring saying that we never bombed this place, and we right in old Göring's face. Anyway, why we were never chased away or shot, I don't know, but we got away with it. And then on one occasion, subsequently, myself and a few of the others who were then able to move around a bit better were allowed to go down, under guard of course, into the gardens and sit with the German soldiers, talking to them and listening to the music, during which time I contacted a German paratrooper and swapped my parachute badge for his, which became one of my war souvenirs. However, during these periods of going downstairs, we found out that there was a cellar underneath the hospital, and on one occasion when the British were bombing Paris, I don't know if it's the only occasion, but certainly on one occasion, we evacuated our ward with anyone who could move was taken down to the cellars by the Germans. And I was one of them. And we noticed that the hospital seemed to be held up on enormously thick stone columns. And around these columns were three rows of wooden benches upon which the patients were laid while the bombing went on, or while the air raid went on. I thought this would be a highly placed to hide, and then it was sort of the germ of the idea of actually getting away, hiding there, and getting out of the hospital eventually was born. Some time later, we'd spoken to Mark Vincent, taking a chance on this, and said, you know, what are the chances of getting out of here? And four or five of us had decided it was worthwhile. And in the event, in the end, it came to a party of about 40 who were going to make a mass break and be taken to various places in Paris. Now this was, it was planned partly by Mark Vincent and partly by a girl called Lynn Rouget, who spoke English and was the daughter of the matron of the Companion Hospital, Hôpital de la Pitié, which was just over a wall, and was called the Salpêtrière, and that was still run by the French as an infirmary for older people. There were no Germans over there at all, and Madame Rouget was the matron of this hospital, and her daughter, speaking English, was allowed to come and help the German nurses to look after we POWs. And we became fairly good friends, and it was said that there was help outside those walls if we could get out. Anyway, provisionally, it was thought that round about the end of March and the beginning of September, there'd be sufficient of us, and we'd have got plans sufficiently organised to make a break, and those who could would have done so, because by that time the Germans were beginning to evacuate Paris. They were moving out a lot of their own wounded, and any of our walking wounded who could be shifted were being moved out as well, and we could visualise ourselves finishing up on a train heading for Germany. However, round about the 18th or 19th of August, the American armour and the French armour division, Division de Clare, was getting very close to Paris, and the Germans began to panic a bit. They were moving people very quickly, and it was obvious that this break was not going to take place. We were going to be moved before that could happen. So on the 20th, 21st
of August,
another group of English were being moved, and we were taken downstairs in groups of 12 with a sentry in front and a sentry behind, both armed, and walked down the stairs and at the bottom of this third flight, turned left to go out onto the forecourt, or the gardens, where the lorries were drawn up to take us away. Well, being a medic, and being known by then to be helping the wounded in this ward, I would go down with them, help those who needed help, the ones with only one leg and, you know, walking on crutches and whatever, go back to the ward, come down with another load, go back to the ward and come down with the third load, which I gathered might possibly be the last load that night. Now, this was about 11 o'clock at night again. So I put myself in the middle of this group of 12 men and went down the stairs, and when I got to the bottom, the fellow in the front had obviously gone outside to see that nobody ran away, and the fellow behind was still two flights up and couldn't see me. I couldn't see him, so he couldn't see me. So I carried on straight down into the basement, and the rest of the 12 men turned left and went out and got in their lorry and were driven away. And that apparently was the last load of the night. So I stayed where I was until, I don't know what time, it must have been about 1 o'clock in the morning, but it was certainly dark. No signs of or sight of people, no sounds of movement around the hospital. So I crept out from my hiding place underneath the lower of these tiers of shelves and made my way towards the back of the hospital. Now, due to the fact that I'd twice been outside, I knew that if I turned left when I got out of the gate, I'd go to the main gate of the hospital, which obviously was under guard. But at the back, there was a tall wooden gate, which I'd guessed to be about 8 to 10 feet high. And I'd also guessed that there'd be wire around it and across the top of it. But to me, that seemed to be the safest way to go. I didn't then know that I could have got over the wall into the other hospital. So I went towards the back of the hospital, being very, very careful where I walked and how I walked, didn't see anybody at all, and climbed over the gate. Bear in mind, I'd only got one really effective leg at that time, and the barbed wire on the top was simply a coil of Dannert wire, nothing very much at all. I cut three strands, I think, of ordinary barbed wire mixed in with it. So I just sort of crushed it to one side and dropped over the top, unfortunately tearing my trousers in so doing, but that wasn't really so severe. And as I landed, more or less on one leg, on the other side of this gate, a shot rang out from outside the hospital. Now, I don't know to this day whether it was somebody shooting at me, somebody shooting at somebody else, a German or a Frenchman. It could have been anybody, because I never did see who did it. But I made my way to a place that I'd been told about by Mark Vincent, which was a post for the French, I think they were the Republican Guard. They were a police unit anyway. And the man in charge of it was a fellow called Alex Hauser, H-A-U-S-E-R. And he said, right, we'll find a place for you. And they put me in a cell where I stayed for the rest of that night and most of the next day. And towards the end of the second day, he came along with somebody else who spoke reasonable English, and said, can you use this? And it was something like a Bren gun. It was a Belgian-made automatic rifle. And I said, well, yes, I suppose so, if you've got any ammunition. So he put me with a group of young men who by that time were zooming around in Citroen trucks with FFI armbands stuck on them and causing a general nuisance of themselves. I don't think we actually killed anybody at all, but we probably frightened a few Frenchmen to death. And then, on the 24th, I think it was, 23rd or 24th, the American Armour and the French Division Leclerc entered Paris. Well, as you can imagine, from then on, there were scenes of great jubilation. I don't think I was sober for about 4 days. I had a lovely time.
Can you give some details about what you saw of the liberation of Paris?
Yes, well, the First of all, I jumped onto an American tank and said, you know, I'm with this small group. We haven't got any weapons. There are still lots of Germans in Paris. There were small groups of diehards, some deserters who were hiding from their own people. These small groups were liable to hole up somewhere and sort of snipe at anybody who happened to be in the streets, French or American or anybody else. So I warned them about this because they just rolled in without much opposition. And I said, have you got any weaponry to spare? So, because we haven't got very much between us and we are sort of chasing around and doing what damage we can. And they gave me a Garand M2 automatic, semi-automatic carbine, a box of ammunition, two smoke grenades, and two ordinary grenades. So I thanked them, said, you know, take it easy, keep your eyes open, have a good time. In the meantime, of course, the place was surrounded by French of all ages, both sexes, old and young. It was marvellous. And as I jumped from the tank, one of these grenades dropped off my belt and rolled onto the pavement. So thank God, is it going to go off or not? But it didn't anyway. Obviously, it still had the pin in, but I wasn't sure of that. There were lots of people in the street, lots of kissing, lots of hugging, lots of bottles of wine, lots of bottles of brandy seemed to appear from nowhere. Somebody gave me a box of peaches, a whole tray of peaches, because I said that about these other prisoners, they're still prisoners in the hospital. I took those back with this Garand stuck over my shoulder and the grenade stuck in my belt, went into the hospital from which the Germans then fully disappeared, and I got told off by some of the blokes up there for walking around with these weapons on, you know. Anyway, I handed out the peaches and everybody enjoyed those. Then I went back and went for walkabout, and I walked eventually to the Place de la Concorde, where this huge monument, Napoleon's victories are, and another place. I got to the Hotel de Ville, mayoral city hall, as it were. And there I saw another fellow with a red beret on. So I said, hey, who are you? And he said, hey, who are you? And he turned out to be the war correspondent for the London Evening News. And I think also the Daily Mail. And he dropped with the airborne. And although there weren't any airborne there at the time, he'd moved in with the American armour. I told him about this hospital. I told him where I'd come from. I said there are still a couple of hundred, at least, Allied wounded there. He said, right, I'll get in touch with somebody. I went back to the hospital, and whilst I was there, I think I spent a night there. Yes. I stayed at a place previously called the Clay de la Chambre. It was a bistro, a pub, and it was run by a French professional footballer called André Simonier, or something like that, who spoke just a little bit of English and had played football in England before the war. And I stayed there one or two nights. I stayed in three places altogether. I can't remember where the others were. And anyway, on this particular night, having seen this war correspondent, whose name I have got, I went back to the hospital. And the following morning, the Americans rolled up, and they started moving us out very, very quickly. I didn't even have time to go and see Lynn Rouget, who was only just across the wall from me, with her mother. I did manage to see Mark Vincent, and I gave him my Garand and the grenades. And some years later, after I returned to, well, 2 years later, after I got back to England and wrote to him again, he said he still had the souvenir that I'd given him, so I presume he meant the Garand. Anyway, I was then moved by the Americans back to Orléans, to a camp there by an airfield, where I heard a Frank Sinatra record. This is a lovely way to spend an evening. I don't know if you know the tune.
Yes.
I thought, how appropriate, you know, I'm going home. Anyway, I was put aboard a Dakota. Oddly enough, that's the aircraft I jumped out of to get into France, and flown home to England. Now, at that particular time, I lived here in Portsmouth, in Southsea, and on Southsea seafront, or near the seafront, is a very distinctive hotel. It's on a corner, it's very large, and it's decorated in the old mock Tudor fashion. And I lived immediately behind it. Malvern Road and the seafront road, Clarence Parade, shared a common service road. And I flew so close that if they'd given me a parachute, I could have jumped out and been home in 5 minutes. Instead of which, we turned west and flew down to Moreton Hampstead in Devon, where I was put into an American hospital there with a lot of other returned POWs, wounded POWs. There, I wasn't allowed to contact my parents until I'd been debriefed. I don't know why, but I wasn't able to get in touch with them at all. However, through channels, I was able to get a telegram sent to my parents saying, I'm home and safe and well. That's all. I was debriefed by British intelligence and put back into the ward. To which I said, well, look, this is damn ridiculous. I'm a trained medic. I've been doing this longer than you people have. I can treat my own wounds. I've been treating other people's for long enough. Why can't I go home? So actually I saw the senior doctor there, and they agreed that I could come home and look after myself. So they gave me a railway warrant and some cash and dispatched me home. When I got back to Portsmouth later that day, I found that my telegram had arrived. My eldest sister Iris, who'd never been out of Portsmouth in her life, had up sticks, borrowed some money, and got a train down to Devon, to Moreton Hampstead. And she turned up at the hospital, only to learn that I'd gone home that morning. Now, we must have passed each other on Exeter Station, because we both had to change there. It was one of the saddest minutes of my life, actually. Then, of course, I learned that my brother Ronnie was dead. I didn't know until then that he'd been killed. And I was given a period of leave, and eventually I went back to Bulford and hobbled around for a bit until I got better, and I started parachuting again. I'd thought that I'd never jump again, quite honestly. But I stayed with the battalion then until the end of the war.
You told me to remind you of something.
Yes. Somebody who was at the farm, I just remembered, he lives at Portis, which is not too far from here. His name is John Meadows.
Well, I'll take his details later.
I've got his address anyway. Now, he was at the farm. He was one of the party who left. And we can't quite decide between us whether he was actually with us when we went to that little cottage or not. Because he and some others broke off and went on a different route. And it's never been quite certain whether he was with us when we came under fire. It's hard to sort it out. But he knows all about the farm. He knows the people. He remembers things that he'd reminded me of. So it's not that he's been reading my story and jumped on the bandwagon. I genuinely believe that he was there. In actual fact, when later on, after the war, we went to one of these reunions that he was there, he saw this girl, Dominique, the granddaughter of the Vermagens, and said, that must be Monique, the girl from the farm. But of course it wasn't, because she was long dead. It was her niece.
Perhaps we'd better say at this point what happened to the Vermagen family.
What happened to them? Yes. As I said, a number of us left the farm. Some had left independently and went off on their own. And we left behind seven fellows who didn't want to risk it, including David Deuce. And there was another man who contacted me after I got home, called Tom Barrett, who has recently died, who said that he was at the farm, and he was one of those who were left behind. And he told me what happened afterwards. Now, there's a discrepancy there, because he told me that the day after we left, the Germans surrounded the farm, moved in, they took away Monsieur and Madame Vermagen, their daughter, the farm foreman, George, and this girl, Mart. March these seven fellows off, and they went on what is known as this death march into Poland. And he himself wasn't liberated till after the war. However, Madame Vermagen's story is that after we left, more men came, and at one time she had 38 men through the farm, not all at one time, but through the farm, and that she wasn't actually, as far as I can make out, the farm wasn't actually surrounded until the beginning of July, which is, we'd been long gone. However, after we left, I say the Germans moved in at some period of time, captured the men who were still there, because obviously they couldn't put up a fight, just seven of them against a German company, and marched them off as prisoners of war. The Vermagens were imprisoned. Actually, they were imprisoned in Pont-l'Evêque, which is the nearest big town apart from Cobourg, where there probably weren't any facilities anyway. From there, Adrian, the farmer, was taken out to a place called Saint-Pierre-Jean-Quay, and with a number of others, another 37 other men, were shot by the Germans. And their bodies were apparently, from what we can gather, were left where they were shot. Subsequently, Madame Vermagen was released with her daughters, went back to the farm, which had been totally destroyed. It had been blown up and burned. All that was left were the back walls of the main building and part of the wall of one of the barns, which is shown on one of the photographs I've shown you.
You mean the Germans had deliberately destroyed it?
Oh, they deliberately destroyed it, yes. They'd driven away all the cattle. We are told that for 2 days they remained there, eating and drinking everything that was available before they actually got the orders to destroy the place. Madame Vermagen then had to take up domestic duties to earn any sort of a living, and her two daughters then joined her back in Cobourg, where she lived for some time. Her husband's body she was able to claim and is at present buried in Cobourg Municipal Cemetery, with that of their daughter Monique, who, as I told you, died of cancer some time later. And George Duval is buried next to him in another grave. And the rest of the men who were there are scattered far and wide. I never met any of the others, apart from this one chap who lives in Portister. Eventually, Madame Vermagen got compensation from the French government, and she lived in a villa in Cobourg called the Villa Ferdinand, which was on the road leading to the farm. But she'd never been back there since she returned after her liberation. The only thing she found there was a single-stemmed wine glass, unbroken. She didn't have anything left of her possessions or a home, and she said if she'd had any sons, she'd have probably lost them too. Anyway, I met her on my way back from Palestine in 1946, when, having come across what was called the Medlock route, we came by boat from Palestine, or from Egypt actually, across the Mediterranean to Toulon, then by train across France to Dieppe, where we were intended then to go across the channel to I forget we were going to come in now. Oh, New Haven. Coming to New Haven, and then up to Aldershot for the mob. However, whilst I was at Dieppe, I applied for compassionate leave to go and find my brother's grave. I knew roughly where he'd been buried. It was near Ranville Church. So I was given 5 days' leave and a railway warrant and some French cash, and sent on my way. Now, a peculiar experience. There's no train service to Cobourg, but there's a train service to Caen. So I got to Caen and discovered there was a bus service to Cobourg. So I went to the bus terminal, caught a single-decker bus to Cobourg, and this bus was quite crowded. So I had to stand. And whilst I was standing there, there was a priest who also spoke some English, and he said to me, you know, who are you, where you've come from, what are you doing here? Bear in mind, this was 1946, in April, 10 months after the end of the, after the D-Day. So I said, well, I was hidden here, near Cobourg, by a family called Vermegem, who, I know that Monsieur Vermegem was shot, and that his wife is living in Cobourg. And I'd, in the meantime, I'd written to the mayor of Cobourg to find out her address, which was given to me, this Villa Ferdinand. So I knew where I was heading for. He said, well, I know Madame Vermegem quite well. She's very well known in Cobourg. So we talked for a bit, and there was a young woman sitting on the bus, and she kept on looking at me very closely, as though she knew me. But she didn't make any other contact. Anyway, when we got to Cobourg, I got off the bus with this young priest, and he showed me which way to go. And this girl jumped off the bus, ran up the road, and shot off into the distance. When I got to this Avenue de la Divette, where the villa was, much to my surprise, a little fat lady came running down the road towards me, with three or four other women trailing in her rear, and this girl who was on the bus. This turned out to be Jacqueline, the daughter of Monsieur and Madame Vermegem, who, as I told you, spoke a little bit of English, and recognised either my photograph or my name, I'm not quite sure which, but knew that I was looking for her mother. And she'd run on ahead to tell her mum that Terry is coming. And, well, I was actually overwhelmed by the reception that I got. So Madame Vermegem then took me to Ranville Cemetery, where I saw my brother's grave. That was in the days when they had the old metal crosses before they actually set the place out properly. I stayed with her for overnight. In fact, she put me up in a hotel who refused to take any payment from me. And I returned to Dieppe and came home from the mob a couple of days later. And I've kept in touch with the Vermegem family ever since, by letter, by postcard, Christmas cards, etc., until in 1971, my daughter Susan, who was then about 19, said, look, Dad, if you don't go to see Madame Vermegem soon, she's going to be dead. You're going to miss your opportunity. So my son Stephen, who was then 17, and Susan and myself went across to Normandy to see Madame Vermegem, having obviously kept in touch with her. We also took the opportunity to go down to Paris to see the hospital from which I'd escaped, and to meet Lynn Rouget, with whom I'd also kept in touch. And we eventually got back to Cobourg, to the villa, and Madame Vermegem apparently had been looking out of the window for us ever since about 3 days before, because she thought we were going to go straight there. I hadn't said we were going to go to Paris as well. And anyway, she looked after the three of us very, very well, took us back to the farm, which was, I say, only the second time she'd been to it since it was destroyed. The first time when she found a stained glass, and the I never went back again until she took me back to see it. So I wasn't exactly sure where it was. And we just saw the ruins of her home, which obviously distressed her very much. Anyway, I kept in touch ever since, until she died. I went to her funeral, where I was persuaded by her daughter. Oh, no, she'd been taken quite ill, and I learned that she was in hospital in Paris. And I said to my wife, well, I'm going to see her. So I simply took 3 days off, got one of these 36-hour trips across to France, and hitchhiked from Rennes, where I finished up, trying to catch a train to Cannes in the pouring rain, put myself up in a hotel for the night, found a taxi to take me to the hospital.